Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll be talking with historian Charlotte Brooks. We'll talk about her new book, The Moys of New York and Shanghai. Born to Chinese immigrant parents, the Moy siblings grew up in an America that questioned their citizenship and denied their equality. Charlotte Brooks' gripping tale follows the family back and forth across the Pacific and through two world wars, China's nationalist and communist revolutions, and the Cold War, events that the siblings and their spouses helped to shape. The Moy story offers a kaleidoscopic view of an entire generation's struggle for acceptance and belonging. Charlotte Brooks is a historian and author who has published widely on Asian American history, especially Chinese American and Chinese diaspora history. Originally from California, she graduated from Yale, worked in mainland China and Hong Kong before earning a PhD from Northwestern University. She's professor of history at Baruch College and CUNY Graduate Center, as well as a proud New Yorker. She joins us from, I think, Brooklyn. Charlotte Brooks, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
How are things in Brooklyn right now?
Too cold. It doesn't. We're starting to get a few blooms, but it doesn't really quite feel like April, you know?
Yeah. It's been
hoping for spring.
Kind of upside down. We're very warm here in the West. It's been kind of upside down this year. Well, interesting book. We'll get into the Moys, sort of Forrest Gumps in a way, and just kind of whet people's appetite. All manner of folks, just in this one family. Got a Nazi broadcaster, some rich folks, ups and downs, and some of these siblings keep going back and forth between China and the U.S. We'll talk about all of that. I want to talk about your background a little bit, Charlotte Brooks. How did you become a historian?
Oh, that's a hard question. I suppose I've always loved history. And, you know, I grew up in California, which has a history for sure, but it's not quite as much written in the buildings and the landscape, at least when I was growing up. Everything seemed to be from, you know, the 70s. And yet when I was growing up, I grew up near Sacramento mainly. And there was, you know, this history of the gold rush there, of Chinese settlement, and actually Japanese American settlement as well. And yet I didn't really know anybody who remembered that. And I was just fascinated by it. And so when I went to college, I wanted to learn more. And I took a lot of different classes. Chinese history really grabbed me. You know, and I worked in China after college, just teaching English. And I worked at the Asian Society in Hong Kong for a year. And then I decided I had seen China up close. This was the early 1990s, before, it was during reform for sure, but it was really before the incredible wealth takeoff of the 2000s. And just seeing really kind of wrenching industrialization and transformation in this early period of China's kind of reform era made me wonder about that in the United States. And I wanted to learn more about my own country, and led me back to graduate school, which I think when I got out of college, I swore I would never do that, never go to graduate school. And yet here I am.
I was reading an interview you gave. You talked about the time in China teaching English. You say you worked for a nonprofit, didn't pay you very much, very expensive city, Hong Kong. and so you were in the library a lot. It's the power of books.
Absolutely. And actually, I love academic history. I love, you know, the kind of deep research and scholarly focused stuff that a lot of us do. But it was really through my reading of, you know, free books from the Hong Kong Public Library, and especially American history books. I started with novels, and that led me back to U.S. history books. And I just remember just being so engaged by them. That was kind of my path back to academic history. And you know, not ashamed to say it, because I think well-written, interesting, engaging narrative is so important in a way to really explain the past to more than just other academics.
So what led you to the Moys? Give the title, The Moys of New York and Shanghai, One Family's Extraordinary Journey Through War and Revolution. How did you find the Moys, and what did you want to do with their story?
You know, it's funny. I first encountered the oldest sibling, or actually the second oldest sibling, the oldest son, Ernest Moy, when I was doing an entirely different project And so I've written three more academically focused histories, and this is my first history for a wider audience. But I've, in a sense, known Ernest, not really, because he died many, many years ago, but I've known him since I was working on this other project back around 2012, 2013. It was a project about Chinese American politics during the Cold War, and I ran into him. And I ran into this very nasty State Department memo about him that threw all kinds of, cast a lot of aspersions on his character. He, at the time, this is the early 1950s, was living between Washington, D.C. and New York and trying to interest the State Department in this pet project of his, which was to help Chinese refugees who were Western educated and had fled the new communist regime, help them resettle in the United States or Taiwan. And so I learned about Ernest this way, very negative memos that said he was a stinker, he was a bad element, nobody should trust him, and then referred to his brother, that you actually mentioned, who was the Nazi broadcaster, who was actually his youngest brother. And so that's how, I learned about this other sibling, Herbert. And then in my third book, which is about Chinese American citizens born in the United States who emigrated to China in the late Qing and early Republican eras, and then all the way up to 1940, I encountered more of the Moy siblings and their spouses. And, in 2020, after that book came out, during the pandemic, I just started thinking, what I really wanted to do next. I think a lot of people do that. We did that during the pandemic. If I emerge healthy, if I've survived this, what do I want to do next? What do I want to do that makes me happy? And I thought about actually all of those years ago in Hong Kong, reading those histories that really engaged me and led me to academic history, and thinking, I want to write something for a wider audience. I want to write something, if possible, about this generation of Chinese Americans who did, in a lot of ways, they were born in the United States, but felt that they did not have much of a future there because of racism and discrimination, the exclusion laws that affected their parents and actually indirectly affected them. So many of them emigrated to China and hoped for a new life, a better life, more career opportunities. And yet there they encountered a different set of obstacles where they weren't really accepted or seen as Chinese, and these are people who had always been told they were Chinese in America. They get to China and they are told, no, you're not really Chinese. And I thought this is a very little known aspect of Chinese American history, even though in this generation, almost half of the people born in the United States emigrated to China. It's a huge part of the Chinese American story. Most of them ended up back in the US, disillusioned or fleeing war. But I wasn't, when I was thinking about, I'd like to tell the story, and I thought, I know the family. I've encountered them. Their stories are so fascinating. And each of them took a route that in a way represented one aspect of the Chinese American experience at this time, whether running a restaurant in the United States or finding a white collar job in America, which is quite rare, or moving to China and trying to serve China, or as in with the youngest brother, losing his way, I think both morally and in a lot of other ways, and doing what it took to survive. And so I thought, wow, I would love to tell this story, and I'm going to try. I think it would be engaging. I think it'd be interesting. And I think it's been, for me, just one of the most rewarding and fun projects I've ever done.
Hmm. I've not been aware of this history. I think we're more aware of the Chinese arriving in America, exclusion laws, the difficulties, discrimination, but this flow back to China, you say it was pretty big numbers of Chinese Americans. I guess I shouldn't say back. In the case of people born in America, this not going back to China. This is going to China.
Yeah, I think it's one of those really understudied and really just not known about phenomenon. I think the reason for that is because, most of these Chinese American citizens who emigrated to China at this time, from about 1901 to 1940, they were the children of what were called the exempt classes, merchants, students, and a handful of other people who were still allowed to come to the United States under exclusion. Exclusion specifically barred laborers, and it was expanded in a lot of ways. But these were the children of what you might consider the more, I don't know, privileged groups of Chinese in America. And for them, their future was really one of downward mobility in the land of their birth. You know, they could not work almost anywhere. Nobody would hire them because of their race. They were educated in the United States and they had citizenship, but a lot of other non-Chinese didn't really respect that citizenship or treat it as equal. And at this time in 1911 to 12, the last dynasty in China collapsed, the Qing dynasty, and there was a young republic. And even before the collapse of the Qing dynasty, there was this move to try to what many Chinese considered modernize along Western lines. And that was Western technology, Western education, Western systems of law and government. But there were not very many Western educated Chinese in the United, or in China at this time. And so for this generation that was Western educated, born in the United States, spoke English, it was this tremendous opportunity. And they saw themselves as valued there. At least they anticipated they would be, and the first, you know, probably few hundred who went were valued. But as more Chinese moved to the United States to study as students short term, got U.S. educations, and then went back, the Chinese Americans who had thought that their educations and credentials would open all doors really struggled. And that's this generation, but that's this family. You know, they want to go to China to be treated equally, to have opportunities. But in the end, they live essentially as expats, as expat Americans. And so it's the identity issue of their generation too. Where do they belong? And I thought that was just really compelling in a lot of ways.
That is compelling. And we'll get into this and tell the stories of these Moy siblings. But maybe in general, you could speak to this. That's painful, not being accepted either place. And struggling with your identity both places.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the United States, the most of the Chinese American population lived in urban areas on the coast, but not necessarily. I mean, there were Chinese American in Utah, in smaller cities, in big towns. There were Chinese Americans all through the Intermountain West and in the South. And they occupied in many places a very strange position where in the South that they, you know, they attended sometimes segregated schools. Sometimes they went to white schools on the West Coast. They were segregated in San Francisco's Chinatown and didn't have many educational opportunities beyond the segregated school that served that neighborhood. And, you know, they were growing up learning about freedom and democracy and liberty and reading the same documents that school children read across the country. And so there was this moment, and for the Moy siblings, it happened to all of them, of confusion and disillusionment. And what's interesting is a lot of those same documents were inspiring to many Chinese revolutionaries in the 1910s. And when Chinese Americans emigrated to China for better opportunities, what they found was initially some of them enjoyed meteoric success. They led universities. One of them was a Supreme Court justice. You know, they became diplomats. But that was the first group. And as more people had the education and the credentials, but also the cultural fluency and the language ability, and these were China-born people who had that growing up, they returned from the United States with a college or PhD degree. The Chinese Americans who have, you know, they speak Toisanese or Cantonese that isn't very polished. Many of them can't read Chinese and their credentials are far less impressive. They don't have the cultural fluency and ability. They're often branded as too American. And so many of them end up living in places with large diaspora populations that have returned, or in places like Shanghai, which had a large foreign population and a large, what was known as overseas Chinese population of people who, like them, had been born abroad in Canada and Australia, had faced racism and come to China for work. So they live in this bubble that in a lot of cases that is neither Chinese nor American, Chinese nor foreign. It's somewhere in between, and it's that place where they can really be both. But it's a very small place. And as time passes, by the late 1930s, with Japanese invasion of China, that bubble shrinks and then it disappears.
Let's take a break. Much more to talk about. We'll get into talking specifically about the Moy siblings. We're talking with historian Charlotte Brooks. Her new book is titled The Moys of New York and Shanghai. More following this brief break.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll visit the epicenter of Latin American rhythms, Cuba. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Son, Salsa, Mambo, Guajira, Guaracha, and Cha-Cha-Cha on Cuba, Cuba, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Thursday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
One day on an Arctic river, hunters in a motorboat alerted a kayaker to his surprise companion.
They said to me, "Did you see that polar bear?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, he's following you."
We hear a firsthand account of the wonders of the Arctic and how climate change is transforming the frozen northern landscape on the next Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking with historian Charlotte Brooks, author of several books. She is a professor of history at Baruch College and the CUNY Graduate Center. And the latest book is The Moys of New York and Shanghai. These Moy citizens grew up in an America that questioned their citizenship and denied their equality. Several of them went went to China, the country of their heritage. And as Charlotte Brooks said before the break, they tend to live in a bubble, not really accepted in either place. And lots happening in this century, of course. Two world wars, China's nationalist and communist revolutions, the Cold War. We'll get into all of this. So, Charlotte Brooks, tell me about it's the patriarch of the family, Moy Singh, who came to America in the 1880s.
So yeah, Moy Singh was actually one of the harder characters, I suppose, to get at in this research, because he came right at the time of the passage of Chinese exclusion. But he has the way that his name is spelled in the records means that he shares a name with about 50 other people. And so I dug through a lot of records and could not find exactly when he entered, but it seems from family lore that it was around 1882 or 83. He came as a merchant when that was still a bit of a wiggly category. There was a sort of moment in the 1880s when it was still possible to come under the exclusion laws as a merchant without really having to do that much to show documentation. He definitely wasn't a laborer, but what I figured out was that he was a literate man who was the younger son in a family from South China, and he basically sold his literacy to laborers who needed it. He could make them seals, he could make them signs for their businesses. He also ran gambling rooms, and this was part of what he did for much of his life in America. He was able to bring his wife over to the United States in the early 1890s, which is very unusual. Most, even merchants, did not do this. But I read the documents I had for him and his wife Han Ying closely, and from what they say, I got the distinct sense, and from other parts of my research, that Han Ying did not really get along well with Moy Singh's mother, which is where she would have been living in the traditional Chinese family arrangement that they had in South China. And so when Moy Singh's father died, he inherited enough money. He wasn't making a lot in the United States. He was living in Chicago, but he inherited enough to bring his wife to the United States. She unusually was literate, so I suspect that she was informing him of her unhappiness in his mother's home, and she seemed to be actually quite a good match. They were about 10 or 15 years apart. She was his second wife. His first had died. But once she came to the United States and joined him, they had a large family, 12 children, only 6 of whom lived. I give you a sense of what her life was like in the first years of her life in the United States. They moved from Chicago to Philadelphia and finally to the New York area, which is where a lot of the early parts of this book take place, and which is really the place where the Moyse siblings thought of as their home for a very long time.
They had 12 children, right? Only 6 of which lived to adulthood. So those 6 siblings, I guess, who you're talking about in the book, the Moyse of New York and Shanghai. You said you first encountered Ernest. Tell me about him.
So Ernest is actually, you know, what I ended up doing, because 6 people, that's a lot of people to do. This is really a family biography, but I don't only write about them. I write about their spouses. And so I've arranged the book in a way to help people keep track of them. I focus on 3 of the central couples. And Ernest is one of the people I focus on, and eventually his wife, Ruth. And, you know, Ernest was well-named. That is not his Chinese name. It's not the name his parents gave him, but it's the name that his school teachers gave him. He was earnest. He was idealistic. He believed in all of the things that his school books told him about America as a land of freedom and democracy. And yet when he was growing up in New York, this is a time of growing anti-Chinese sentiment there. I talk a little bit about why that was. There were some specific incidents. So he grew up also being harassed for being a young Chinese American man. He went through high school. I don't believe he graduated in New York, but he was also entranced by the revolutionary activism of some of his peers and older teens and young 20-something men in New York's Chinatown. And that was activism around what eventually became, after 1911, the Chinese Nationalist Party, what this time was known in English as the Young China Party, or in Chinese as the Tongmenghui. This was Sun Yat-sen, the revolutionary, his party, his organization to overthrow the Qing Dynasty. And Ernest joined it at a very young age when he was a high school student, and he followed it the rest of his life. So he was both an American patriot who was very interested in American politics, and he was a member of the Chinese Nationalist Party, who was very interested in creating a particular model of a modern China. And these 2 streams were really, you know, that's how I describe him all the way up to his death in 1958, and they were really what guided his life.
So an American patriot, but viewed in some circles with suspicion.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, Chinese immigrants and those were the people that the Chinese exclusion law was meant to keep out. But it was also meant in a lot of ways to prevent the creation of a second generation, a Chinese American generation. And of course, in 1898, the Supreme Court recognized the birthright citizenship of Chinese Americans born on U.S. soil. And a lot of Americans, including immigration officials, did not really fully recognize that, or they only grudgingly recognized that. And that was Ernest's experience his whole life. So, you know, when I introduce him in the book, it's in an immigration interview. His father was very canny. He kept all the birth certificates or the birth registrations of the children that his wife had had, but who had not survived infancy. And that was 6 children. 3 of them were infant sons who had died. And these were, you know, these were precious documents that Moyse Singh then tried to sell to young men in China who wanted to enter the United States, but, you know, had to deal with Chinese exclusion. And so Ernest's first real encounter with immigration authorities was when they came to his apartment to interview him, really to interrogate him about the claim of one of these young men who was trying to enter the U.S. claiming to be Ernest's younger brother. And of course, Ernest didn't have this younger brother. The infant had died probably within a week of its birth, but the parents had registered him before that. And Ernest totally flubs the interrogation. His father hasn't prepared him. Nobody's talked to him about this, but that's his first experience as pretty much a 16-year-old of what it is like to be Chinese American in a country that where the vast majority of people regard you as not wholly American, and the government and the immigration service regard you as inherently undesirable and assimilable and probably cheating and lying. And yes, his father is cheating and lying, but Ernest, you know, he believes, and there's this cognitive dissonance for him of truly believing in the promise of America and yet at every turn encountering disdain. One of the things I weave into this story of Ernest, because I encountered it myself in researching him, was that when possible, he is a serial resume inflator, right? He embroiders his resume. He sort of punches up what he really is a little bit more. You know, he's not a secretary of this organization. He's the executive secretary and founder. Like, it's never, he has a deep insecurity, but it's a deep insecurity that is the product of living in America that questions you over and over.
If you just joined us, we're talking with historian Charlotte Brooks. The new book is The Moise of New York and Shanghai. So you said that in this document that you unearthed, there was some suspicion cast upon, or they were using suspicion to cast upon Ernest from his brother Herbert. And Herbert did have some problematic aspects to his biography. So tell me about Herbert. Herbert ended up ended up in Shanghai and ended up as a propagandist for the Axis powers.
Yeah, I think if anybody, and I'm sure nobody, but if anybody had heard of the Moy family before this book, it was through Herbert Moy. So actually, Herbert was one of the reasons I compiled so much research about this family early on, even though I didn't decide to write this book about all of them until just a few years ago. Because when I ran into Ernest and I learned that his brother was supposed to have been an Axis propagandist, a Nazi broadcaster working for the radio station owned by the Germans in Shanghai during World War II, I was absolutely floored and then fascinated. And I wanted to understand why somebody had done this, why someone who is Chinese American at a time when in the United States, Chinese Americans were wholeheartedly, you know, embracing the Allied cause because the United States was finally jumping into the war against China's longtime occupier, Japan. And so I did a lot of research on Herbert. I found his FBI file. I found the missing, kind of misfiled part of his FBI file. I did a ton of research. I even got his school records, and found, you know, the strange story of his brief marriage. And so I had done all this research on him. He seems from a very early age, he was the youngest child in this large family. His parents were on the older side when they had him. He had a lot of doting siblings. He was spoiled, but I think at the same time, he also came of age at a time when the kind of hollowness of his parents' life choices, not the choices they made, but the options they had, were becoming particularly apparent. So he is born in 1911, just a few months before the Chinese Revolution. He grows up hearing his siblings' idealistic and patriotic ideas. But by the time he is in high school, his parents have moved to Newark. Newark, New Jersey at that time was the center of Chinese gambling, which had been driven out of New York City. And so Moising moves his family across the river. Newark isn't very far, but it becomes the Chinatown there is the center of sort of a low-level police-tolerated gambling industry that eventually the police stopped tolerating. And so Herbert, I think, grows up with the cynicism. He hears Ernest's idealism, but at the same time, he sees the kinds of choices that are available to a young man of his background in the United States, and there aren't many. And finally, in 1932, for a lot of reasons, he and his parents and his next brother, Bill, they moved to China. And it's kind of a hard, I explain this very briefly in the book, but of course, the Depression had hit the United States by then. And Herbert and Bill both look for work. They can't find work. But the parents, Moixing and Hanying, now quite old, they have a little bit of money left, and it goes much farther in China, but also they move to Shanghai because Ernest is already in Shanghai and says, I can find you jobs. The economy hasn't gone south in China yet. So they all go to China. And Herbert becomes basically a party boy. You can see his true character coming out. He's not a hard worker. He's drawn to the glamour. He loves flitting around. He drinks pretty heavily. And finally, he gets a job as a radio broadcaster, and he loves it. And you see this rather lazy, spoiled, pampered kid find something that he's really drawn to and he's good at. And then it all gets threatened in 1937 when the Japanese and Chinese go to war. The Japanese and Chinese fight this prolonged battle in Shanghai. And this is the beginning of what we call the Second Sino-Japanese War, but it's really early World War II. It's when the Japanese invade China and occupy it. And Herbert knows that if he leaves, like some of his siblings do, if he leaves China for safety to the United States, his career options will end. He will not get to continue working in radio. He will most likely do what Bill ends up doing, which is working as a waiter in a chop suey restaurant. There are just no other options for Chinese Americans because of discrimination and the Depression. He holds out a little longer. He's working at this radio station, but he's attacked as a popular broadcaster by a pro-Japanese terrorist, and he's terrified. And so he's really stuck. You know, am I going to go back to the U.S. and live the life I don't want to have? Or what are my other options? And then he is invited to meet with the founders of this radio station, XGRS, which stood for German Radio Station, founded in 1940, right at the time when really early months of World War II in Europe. And they offer him a tremendous amount of money to broadcast for them, not in Chinese, because he can't speak Chinese very well, but in English. They sense he has potential, and he jumps at the chance. And when people ask him why, he offers all kinds of changing rationales. Oh, you know, I need the money for my father, who's an opium addict. We don't know this for sure. It doesn't seem to be the case. Plus, he has other siblings who are fairly, you know, financially successful in Shanghai. Or I'm protecting my older brother, Ernest. But Ernest has left China, or it's gone to Hong Kong at this point. There's all kinds of excuses. And finally, his old boss at the other radio station says, why are you doing this? And he says, well, Frank, they're willing to pay me much more than you will. And that is the truth, right? He's in it for the money, but also he gets to stay in Shanghai, this glamorous place. He becomes a star. His broadcasts are very popular among a lot of Chinese who hate the British. He hates the British because the British essentially were the ones who had reduced China to this powerless position, mini Phil. And, you know, he gets to live a star-crusted, glamorous life where he is really important. And women flock to him. He has a million girlfriends, and he goes to all the nightclubs, and he gets bodyguards because he needs them, because after Pearl Harbor, when Americans are still actually able to move at large in Shanghai, he is beaten up by a group of Americans at a nightclub. So he gets bodyguards, he gets a car, he gets all these fancy things while Shanghai is basically crumbling. He is deeply immoral, but he is also very, very good at rationalizing. And it's really a sad story.
Hmm. A very human story, right? And what a contrast, Ernest and Herbert, right? Siblings, but different character, moral character, and a different paths for their lives as a result.
Absolutely. I mean, what's interesting about Ernest is that Ernest has been working for a kind of a quasi-foreign, quasi-government agency in Shanghai. And he has to leave in 1940 because essentially it becomes unsafe for him because of the growing Japanese power in Shanghai. It's very complicated, but part of Shanghai was actually under foreign control at that time, outside of Japan's occupation area. But Ernest has to flee. He ends up in Hong Kong, and after Pearl Harbor, I think most Americans don't know, they probably kind of understand that after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese also attacked a number of other places. The U.S. controlled Philippines, but British controlled Hong Kong, which fell to the Japanese on Christmas Day, 1941. And Ernest was trapped in Hong Kong. You know, he is known to the Japanese. He goes underground. And part of what I chronicle in the book is his escape from Hong Kong, his long trek with friends into what was known as Free China. And he lived in unoccupied China, the part where the nationalist government still controlled. And he worked there through to the end of the war. So on the one hand, you have Ernest, who is working for the anti-Japanese nationalist government in far western China. And you have Herbert, who is broadcasting, and his brother can hear him. They can all hear him, broadcasting from Shanghai nightly. Essentially, he's working for the Germans, but when the Germans lose the war in Europe, he eventually throws his lot in with the Japanese. And Ernest's wife, from whom he's a little bit estranged at this point, is also living in Shanghai, and she has opened her apartment to U.S. intelligence underground agents. And so there are a lot of different pieces going on here, but you have family members who are really taking many different sides in this tremendous global conflict, but also just trying to stay alive.
Yeah, it's a fascinating history. The book is The Moise of New York and Shanghai. The author is historian Charlotte Brooks. Let's take another brief break. We'll be back. I want to talk in the next segment about Alice. Fascinating, maybe even more fascinating than the rest, the youngest daughter. We'll have more following this break.
And the question is, what is one of the most popular locally produced programs on Utah Public Radio? The answer, Wild About Utah, a weekly program featuring fun, educational, and unique information about our state and all things wild. Also, the topic of an upcoming UPR-sponsored trivia night. UPR and Questionable Productions invite you to a Wild About Utah trivia night at the Cash Bar in Logan. Gather your teams and your trivia passion for an evening of fun competition with prizes. Your ticket price includes a pasta bar and your team's opportunity to prove you are wild about trivia and wild about Utah. Purchase your tickets now at upr.org for the Wild About Utah Trivia Night, happening on Tuesday, April 14th at the Cash Bar, 119 Main in Logan. Again, details at upr.org.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with historian Charlotte Brooks. The latest book, fascinating book, The Moise of New York and Shanghai. That's out and available for you to read if you're piqued by these stories that Charlotte Brooks is telling. So Charlotte Brooks, Alice Moy, the youngest daughter, described as charming, spoiled, maybe just a fascinating history. Tell me a bit about Alice.
Alice was sort of an unexpected surprise for me when I was doing research for this book. She, everybody I talked to who remembered her, and that was actually one of the interesting things, the last of the Moy siblings, and she was the last to pass away in the very early 90s. But there are people who lived in Shanghai with them I interviewed. This is people who remember this from the 1940s, her nephews, her grandkids. And to a person, they all said, oh, she was the life of the party, a free spirit, maybe she's a little pampered, a little spoiled, maybe a lot spoiled, and yet charming, charismatic. And she was one of the interesting parts of this book because, you know, each of these siblings, I tell a little bit about the life of Chinese Americans during exclusion through them. And Alice has a pretty unique story in that. She was born in New York. She was living with her parents when they moved to Newark, and she just finished high school. She was terribly bored in Newark. All her friends were getting married. You know, they seemed to have purpose in their life, her sisters. And it seems upon a complete impulse, she married a Chinese student born in Guangdong province, so, you know, a China-born student who was just in the United States to study and do a little bit of work experience, and then he planned to return to China. He did not have the right under American law at that time to become a citizen. And by marrying him at that time, under U.S. law, Alice lost her citizenship. So she's born in the U.S. with birthright citizenship, but because of a particular part of laws at that time, if you were Asian American, an Asian American citizen, and you married an alien ineligible for citizenship, which meant somebody else who was an Asian immigrant, you lost your citizenship and became yourself an alien ineligible for citizenship because of your race. Something not a lot of people know about, but it happened to a good number of Chinese American women. And so she lost her citizenship. She went back to China with this man who was named K.S. Low. The marriage did not last long. They were not very temperamentally suited. And it did not help that when they moved to Shanghai, he opened a factory using his American know-how with a friend of his. And it happened to be a very bad time, a very tumultuous political moment. And the factory basically went under within about a year. And that's kind of when Alice's pampered, spoiled aspects come out, because I found the reminiscences of K.S. Lowe's old friend who said, you know, after the factory went bankrupt, K.S.'s young wife left him and implied basically that it was because he didn't have any money anymore. And he had never had that much money. But I think that for Alice, the excitement of being in China, the belief that she would live this glamorous life faded away very quickly. And she and K.S. now had a young son. They were living in quite straitened circumstances. She missed home, I think. She missed the life she'd expected to have, the parties, all the excitement that they couldn't afford. They couldn't go out to restaurants. They couldn't go to movies. And she couldn't go home because she'd lost her citizenship. And she couldn't even go home temporarily because she didn't have the money because they were broke. And part of what I talk about in the book is how, at that point, a young man who she had known as a friend in New York and had been in love with her for a very long time, moved to Shanghai, figured out what was going on, and basically said, you know, I will save you from this. His name is Alfred Lee. And she got K.S. to agree to divorce. I think he probably realized she wasn't happy either. And eventually she remarried. She married Alfred Lee. And a lot of their friends, really their family members, sort of looked askance on this initially. You know, Alice is just doing this for the money. She's unhappy, but she wants this luxurious life. But the interesting thing about this Alice story is that when I first started researching it, I thought about her as this pampered and spoiled. And yes, she was, absolutely. But I realized by the end I was writing something of a love story, that she and Alfred had, you know, they had found happiness together in whatever way that was. And that when they had to leave China and they, you know, Alfred loved Shanghai. He loved having the life that he could not have had as a Chinese American in the United States. And he grew up in San Francisco, where he grew up in segregated schools with very limited work opportunities. He built a very nice life for them in Shanghai. He was a very successful businessman. They lived in quite nice style, you know, the kind of parties, the kind of luxuries, the servants, a country home. And yet they had to leave all of that behind in 1949 when the communists took over the mainland. And Alfred left about 36 hours before the communists took Shanghai. He'd sent Alice before him and he lost everything. And he came back to America and had no savings really, had to work as a janitor for his brother in San Francisco, and then as a waiter in New York for a long time. And Alice is really the one who found the strength to kind of keep him going and guide him to a new life, and help their son, who Alfred had adopted. They only had the one son that was Roy K.S. Lowe's child, and fought his deportation. And it was this really long story about love in the end, about finding a strength, though she was spoiled, pampered to the end of her life. Her grandchildren said to me, God, she hated to cook. You know, that was the thing. She hated to cook. She didn't like doing all these housekeeping stuff. But she found a new strength to build a new life in the United States. And so I think in a way I underestimated her when I first started doing research on her. But I came to respect her and like her a great deal by the end of the book.
Yeah, I was fascinated by it. We're now at the end of our time here. But you did mention it. Alfred had two great loves, Alice and Shanghai, Right. And then tragically was forced to leave Shanghai and come back. Sweep of history here. Very human, but illustrating the sweep of history. I wonder, just about a minute left in the conversation here, what do you take away from your time with the Moyes?
I think in a lot of ways that what I'm talking about are these giant sweeps of history and things that a lot of Americans don't know about in Chinese history and the connection with U.S. history. But I think it's possible to understand these better through these individual stories. I think they're a way to help us understand at a more human level what this meant to the people who were really swept up in these huge, huge events. And I think a lot of us have some glimmer of these stories in our own backgrounds. And I think a lot of these people in some ways will be very familiar to us. They remind us of a cousin, a friend, an uncle who, you know, certainly in my family, I felt that way. And so I like that about the Moyes. They're extremely human and very relatable. And their story is also crazy.
Yeah, fascinating history. That's, of course, we just scratched the surface here in this conversation. Go read the book. The book is The Moyes of New York and Shanghai. We've been talking with the author, historian Charlotte Brooks. Charlotte Brooks, thank you so much for the conversation.
Oh, it's a delight to be on. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.